Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
We're underway, and welcome to APAC Channel 648 on Foxtel and Austar, who are here tonight. So please don't stand in front of the camera. Okay. David Maher and Nicholas Stewart make welcome returns to the Sydney Institute. David's been here on quite a few occasions. Nicholas on one occasion. I'll introduce them briefly. We're going to lead off with David Maher, who's the multi-award winning author of Patrick White, A Life and The High Price of Freedom, and co-author with Marion Wilkinson of Dark Victory. And he's worked in journalism for about 3 decades, and he's written for The Bulletin and, of course, for the Sydney Morning Herald, where he currently is, and has been editor of the National Times, a reporter for Four Corners, and a presenter of the ABC TV Media Watch program, among many other achievements. Nicholas Stewart joined the ABC in 1985. He worked in radio news, ABC Radio Current Affairs, and ABC TV, and was the ABC's Indochina correspondent before returning to Australia. He's a regular columnist these days for the Canberra Times, and he's written 2 books analysing labour and politics, Kevin Rudd, an unauthorised political biography, for which Nicholas Stewart addressed the Institute some years ago, and What Goes Up Behind the 2007 Election. Now, Janet Grundy's got copies of both David Maher's most recent publication, Power Trip, The Political Journey of Kevin Rudd, and of Nicholas Stewart's book, Rudd's Way, November 2007 to June 2010. David Maher's going to lead off, followed by Nicholas Stewart. And the general topic is Kevin Rudd, the Rudd government, and the downfall of Kevin Rudd. So we lead off with David Maher. Many thanks, and then Nicholas Stewart.
Thanks, David. I don't haunt the Patrick White world, but last year I was invited to give a lecture in London in June this year at a conference, at a Patrick White conference. And it was to be the, and was indeed, the Menzies Lecture for 2010 on the subject of Patrick White, and I chose the subject as Patrick White and his lifelong affection for London, and his declaration the morning after he won the Nobel Prize, just as Australia was trying to claim him at last as absolutely its own, his declaration to the press that he was actually a Londoner at heart. So that was my reason for being in London and my reason for crossing Russell Square about midday on the 23rd of June when my phone burped and delivered this message. Wow, just as well your essay sold well early, exclamation mark. It was from my friend Fran Kelly. My first thought was that that the essay had been injuncted, that I was being sued, and that it had been withdrawn from the market. So I quickly texted back, "What's happened?" A few minutes later, me standing in the middle of Russell Square, "Nothing yet. Julia's still in Rudd's office. Sky quotes the right has shifted against KR. He's stuffed." At which point, I thought of page 5 of my essay, where I state emphatically, there was speculation that he was in a very delicate position, essentially friendless in the party and ripe for decapitation by Julia Gillard even before the looming elections. This is rubbish. A sentence I have held up to defend myself against those who claim that the outcome was one I wished, and that I had blood on my hands. I don't believe I had blood on my hands, and it was certainly not the outcome that I wished. I think the downfall of Rudd is the most extraordinary political event since 1975. It doesn't have the interesting constitutional aspects, but it is a truly extraordinary event. And I think one of the things we have to do now is to hold on to the reality of the Rudd government and Rudd's rise to power and not read everything about it through the prism of his fall. Because from the time he became leader of the opposition in late 2006 until the end of 2009, a remarkable 3 years, he was one of the most popular politicians this country has known, certainly in the age of polling. His buoyant opinion polling was a remarkable testament to the ability he had had to seize the imagination of this country and give the country that sense of hope, which is essential, really, for any political leader bringing the opposition to government. Politicians raise our hopes. In the end, that is why we vote for them. They always, of course, disappoint. And the great art of politics is to let the supporters down lightly. Rudd let his supporters down heavily. And the reasons for this will be much debated for a very long time. And Nicholas's book goes into the detail of the calamities of the Rudd government with great forensic anger, I might almost say, an anger that I don't entirely share. But I think in a nutshell what happened was this. He arrived promising very little change. The reality was that he had an agenda for transformative change in Australia. His ambitions were huge, and he found himself unable to achieve any of them, really, any of the major ones. He was up against one of the most difficult to deal with senates in the history of the Federation, Fielding. There is a man who was so unlike Brian Harradine. Brian Harradine, for periods of time, had held the kind of balance of power in the Senate. He was a man who was open to argument, who understood his public responsibilities. And while I didn't by any means agree with everything he did, I watched him, for instance, in the native title debate, when his vote counted. I watched Parliament operating as the textbooks tell us Parliament should operate. There was a man there who needed to be persuaded. If he was persuaded, something became law. If he wasn't persuaded, it didn't become law. The contrast to Family First and the shambles of the last 3 years is extraordinary. And Rudd had to face a Senate that was a blocking Senate, in almost up there with some of the worst blocking Senates of the period. Nothing makes a government look more foolish than the inability to achieve its legislative programme, and the opposition successfully, while it allowed some controversial legislation through, of course, it successfully made Rudd look inept. An astonishingly similar program to what's happening in the United States of America, to an in many ways similar politician who had also raised the hopes of transformative change, only to find most of them dashed. Rudd's opinion polling was actually sagging in the middle of 2009. What happened at that point was the Godwin-Gretsch affair. The Godwin-Gretsch affair was so superbly handled by Rudd, so appallingly badly handled by Malcolm Turnbull, and my personal favourite amongst all politicians in Australia, Eric Abetz, that Rudd's approval ratings shot up again, and he approached the Copenhagen disaster with elevated approval ratings because of the job he had done on Turnbull over Utegate. Copenhagen came, Copenhagen was a complete disaster, and Rudd emerged from that battered, wounded, and reduced. But what happened then, in my argument, this is, I think, is where Nicholas and I part company, what happened then is that Rudd lost his nerve and turned more than ever for advice to a small group of his sort of inner circle, and in particular to those ornaments to New South Wales politics, Abib and Bitar, and also, of course, to Julia Gillard and to Wayne Swan. These were the people who persuaded him not to have a double dissolution election, fighting a clean double dissolution election on the issues of health and emissions trading. These are the same people who advised him that what was more important than anything else was getting the budget into surplus quickly, and therefore the ETS should be postponed indefinitely. Those two moves destroyed the standing of Rudd with the general public because they exposed him to the accusation, which I actually think is wrong, but the accusation that he was insincere in his beliefs and insincere in his claims to pursue the policies that he was pursuing. It's curious, isn't it, the way in which those who are guilty of disasters can benefit so markedly from them. And I know I'm not drawing a real parallel with this, but of course the greatest example in the last sort of century in our world was the way Churchill came to power. Churchill advised Chamberlain that the thing to do was to have a surgical, brilliant operation in Norway to prevent the Germans overrunning Norway, and it was a complete, utter, bloody catastrophe. Chamberlain resigned, and Churchill became Prime Minister of Great Britain. Now, we're not talking on that scale here in Australia, but the demolition of Rudd's standing with the public was brought about by him taking the advice of the people who are now running Australia. Now, he helped all of this in ways that I think we'll talk about more in question time by the most astonishing notion of power. I was there when he won, Victory Night 2007, and many of you I know will have seen his speech on television, and I'm sure many of you, like me, who was there watching it, at the foot of the stage, were completely puzzled by his attitude, his bizarre attitude on the stage. It's puzzled me for years. I think now I've worked out, in terms of what we know was happening in Canberra for those years, that Rudd had the strange notion that he had been given power as a personal possession, that it was his own, and that he would exercise it as if it were his own. Because having won power, and having won it by all the traditional methods of courting support in the union movement, courting support in the caucus, courting support with the public, he then proceeded to lock down and exercise it as if none of that support mattered anymore, and it was all simply up to him. Now, I'm not for a moment saying that he was pursuing sort of megalomaniacal objectives. He wasn't. But he believed the power was his and his alone to exercise. I've spoken to some senior ministers since the sacking. In fact, I was having a chat to a few of them only in the last few days to ask, why sack the man? Why not intervene, lay it on the line and say, unless you restore cabinet government, open your door once again to ministers, behave decently to public servants, treat your backbench with respect, we will take power from you. It's what used to be called a few years ago an intervention, you know. You, four or five of you would go and beg your mother to stop smoking, that kind of thing. And the reply from these ministers is that it was impossible because he would not listen to anyone. You could not get to him, he would not listen. So they executed him instead. Now, the execution was carried out in the belief that Julia Gillard was such an astonishing political talent that she would sweep away, by her immediate popularity, she would sweep away any questions about her rise to power and the impact on a party because of it. That does not seem to have quite worked out that way, and so the story, or perhaps the soap opera, continues to evolve. Okay, now I'm going to leave it there and hand over to Nicholas, and then we'll have some questions about all this.
Thanks, David. I think that was, I would agree with everything that David said, apart from one thing. I suspect that that quarterly essay that he wrote, which wasn't intended to bring Kevin Rudd down, I think that it did. Because what I'd been working on was this book. This book is fantastic. It's like a thick broadsword slagging away at the enemy and having a go, trying to find the faults with Rudd's government. David Marr's little essay was a fantastic rapier-like thrust that went straight to the heart, touched exactly the quick, and as a result of that, the most important thing about it was it returned Rudd's humanity to the man. And suddenly, the minute you started seeing Rudd as a person rather than a prime minister, I feel that his flaws became highlighted. And this was what gave the New South Wales Right and others the courage to actually take him on, because finally you had someone who was very esteemed, a very astute observer of both politics and human nature, coming up, and definitely someone with left-wing credentials, coming up and saying, this man is not what he claims to be. And that was enough to give them the opportunity to prise the door open and thrust Kevin Rudd out into the cold. And I think they seized it with glee. With glee, some of them. Others rather less so and with apprehension. But otherwise, I completely agree with everything David said. But let me get to my story of the time. Now, I've been working on this book for a long time. It was very worthy. It really was. I'd spoken to a lot of people, and I heard that something was happening. There was the possibility of a move going to be made on Kevin Rudd. And so I realised the key moment, you don't need to be particularly astute to understand this. If you look back at when Kevin Rudd took over, it was the last day of the parliamentary winter session. At this time, the last day of the first day before the winter break had to be the time that the assassins would strike, if they were going to strike. And that worked in quite well because there was the Penrith by-election on the Saturday beforehand. Of course, Labor got the worst result in Penrith that it had ever received in a New South Wales election, lowest primary result ever. And so as a result of that, the reason to get rid of Kevin Rudd was there. As well as that, David Marr had set the scene with his wonderful quarterly essay, so it could all be blamed on Kevin Rudd. And I was really, you know, worried because I had my book. And so anyway, I phoned everyone who spoke in the caucus meeting, with the exception, obviously, of the Prime Minister, the then Prime Minister. But I spoke to all the backbenchers. And by the Tuesday afternoon, I felt I was certain that there was no move on. I thought that Rudd was going to remain Prime Minister till the end of the sitting, another 48 hours, and as a result of that, he would take the country to the election. So I was just about ready to go with my book, and then I tidied up a few little bits. The next day, at about 3:30 on the Wednesday afternoon, I filed it all to Henry Rosenblum, my publisher at Scribe, and I was quite happy, and I sat back, and I actually opened a champagne early. And it was very good. Until 7 o'clock. And then Chris Ullman. Officially it was not Chris, although practically it was Chris, as David says. He knew what was going on, and of course, half an hour later, I was back in a Parliament House trying to work out what was actually going on and whether or not the book would stand and whether or not, you know, how much rewriting would need to be done. Then I realised that just as David Marr had given an excuse to the plotters, I had given what effectively worked as a cogent explanation of their reasons for dispatching Rudd. So as a result of that, I think the book had an extra chapter quickly written and added on the end. Henry said there's no time for an index. So Henry is a wise publisher. He knows that there's only about another 3 weeks of sales for this. So I urge you to buy your copy now while you can get it before it's discounted. Come on, you're the wealthy Sydney Institute intellectual mob. Now, that's enough. I just noticed Gerard looking at me then, so I think I've plugged the book enough. If I can go back to the theme of this discussion, it really, as David has said, it was Kevin Rudd's government right from the beginning, from that very first moment. And then there were a succession of events that reinforced this. For example, in the areas like foreign affairs and defence, it had been known for a long time that Kevin was a policy wonk. So Stephen Smith really didn't expect to have a great deal of autonomy in his department, I would expect, although he denies this. He's personally said to me that he's achieved everything he wants to, and he didn't have to run a lot of things past Kevin, a lot of things, although occasionally ambassadors and others would be vetoed by Kevin, but anyway. And equally, Joel Fitzgibbon, the Defence Minister, insisted that he had total and complete control of the Defence White Paper, which doesn't necessarily entirely accord with another story I heard, which comes from an extremely reputable source, which suggests that actually the person who was writing the White Paper went and had a chat to Kevin early on. He got the paper basically formatted. A bit like my book, really. Was certain that he knew what he wanted to say in the White Paper. Then he went and had a chat to Kevin one night at Parliament House. Kevin said, basically, look, I think you've just got this wrong. And the guy said, what do I need to do? And Kevin suggested, well, listen to my speech in Townsville next Thursday to the RSL. And amazingly, the speech in Townsville sounded more or less like a blueprint for a white paper. And the white paper that eventually turned out was exactly like that speech in Townsville. So I think Kevin was getting things done by remote control. He did delegate, and he could delegate at that stage, and as a result of that, the government was beginning to work. I think the problem, the first difficulty crept in with the global financial crisis. That was something that required instant decisions immediately by a very small group of people, effectively three: Ken Henry, Kevin Rudd, and Wayne Swan. Someone else here, Wayne Swan, that's the bloke. Anyway, as a result of that, it basically became, in those early stages, a gang of two that were running the country. Then gradually Julia forced herself in, and finally Lindsay Tanner, who had a bit of a past with Julia Gillard, made it a gang of three and a half. Rather than perhaps a gang of four, as some people might have been saying. But anyway, the point is that Kevin Rudd, the man, was very much at the centre of this. And so he became Kevin Rudd, the PM. He became like a empty vessel that we poured our hopes and desires into. And he certainly, his rhetoric demonstrated conclusively that he understood what we wanted and he was trying to fulfil our desires. And that's, I suspect, why the polls remained so high for so long, because he did empathise with us, and I think he quite genuinely wanted to assist getting Australia to the place that he was talking about. But the trouble was, as power became increasingly centralised in the office of the Prime Minister, it meant that the Cabinet government effectively stopped working. And that meant that effectively the government stopped working, because you can't centralise everything in one person or in the office of one person. And so that meant that you had not only an individual who was beginning, who may have been predisposed. I'm not, certainly not qualified to make any psychological judgments, but you've got someone who was individually perhaps suited to a particular to particular individual. I'm not doing this very well, am I? I'm trying to think what not to say. Obviously, you know, a bloke with no psychological problems, that's the easy way out, isn't it? He insisted that he was just doing things appropriately. The problem was that obviously the office wasn't working. He himself wasn't contacting other people, even members of caucus. He didn't invite members of caucus round. I mean, one of the worst things was the story that provoked the challenge by Julia Gillard was that Alastair Jordan, Kevin Rudd's chief of staff, had gone round speaking to Labour politicians about whether they supported Kevin Rudd or not. You know, that's not the sort of thing that any politician, particularly a prime minister, can outsource. You need to do that sort of thing yourself. So finally, I think we ended up with a individual who was just waiting to fall. It was just a matter of time before that fall came. I am certain that there was that actually the intention was not originally to put Julia Gillard in the job. I think that there was a longer-term agenda run by the New South Wales Right to put somebody else in that place, but because they got spooked, basically, because of the polling, they thought they had to act quickly, so they acted, and that has left us in the current situation. But I think that, the final point I want to make is that what can we learn from this? Well, I think the key thing is that we shouldn't buy into the celebrity culture of politics. We in the media desperately try to elevate celebrities and say, this is what our politics is like. It's about these individuals who grow into the job and they are unique, they are somehow different, and so as a result of that, they are the Prime Minister. I think the problem was, eventually, prime ministers, all of them that I've seen, seem to believe that that propaganda. It's not true. They are all just individuals. And I think Kevin Rudd believed it faster than a lot of other people did. And I think as a result of that, the problems were magnified. And the minute that he just trod on a banana skin of the polls, there were people ready to push him off the stage. And I think that the problem is not necessarily for Kevin Rudd, the problem is for Australia, because we are going further and further down that path, and I think it's a bad place that we don't want to go.
So, thanks to our two speakers who have kept to their time, and so we've got until 7 o'clock, so we've got right on half an hour for questions and discussion. Before I go to them, I should say two things. Firstly, thanks to Gilbert and Tobin for the use of this fine facility this evening. And secondly, just to remind you, there's copies of Nicholas Stewart's Rudd's Way and David Marr's Power Trip, which Janet Grundy's got, and also, and of course, sells copies of books online after the event. So now we come to question and discussion. I may get both of you to stand either side. I'll just lead off with a question to both of you. Firstly, to David Marr. Nicholas, one there, one there. If I was working for Kevin Rudd, I would have advised him not to speak to you, but he did speak to you, and he seems rather embittered about it, because both before he lost the position at the National, at the Midwinter Ball in Canberra, and later on the Philip Adams program, you seem rather embittered. So what were your own impressions of the major conversation you had with Rudd, which you wrote about, but just how do you feel about him personally? And also, Nicholas, I think you got one interview with Kevin Rudd after your book came out, two after the book came out, so the first book came out. So just talk a bit about your own personal relationships with the Prime Minister. So let's lead off with, or the former Prime Minister.
Okay. Well, all went really well until it went really badly. I found him intriguing company of a broad range of reference, of sharp intellect. He was funny. I felt able to ask him some, off the record, some astonishingly intimate questions, which I just felt that I could, and we had a very candid couple of discussions. I mean, the best of them was a walk along the beach at Mackay as the sun was coming down, coal boats queued up all the way along the horizon, him and me in our shorts and bare feet with no more company than two security guards, making our way along the beach at Mackay. And I enjoyed it very much indeed. And I wish I could tell you exactly what we said, but it's everywhere all through the essay, what I learned in that time. Then we had dinner, and it was terrific. And it was only after dinner that he asked me, well, what is the argument of your essay? And I thought this was one of the most unusual situations I'd ever been in my life. But he asked me, and I told him, and he was very hurt, and there was, and he was very, very angry with me. And while I'm not for the moment suggesting there's one explanation for Kevin Rudd, and that is anger, which some people have taken from my essay, I did see at that point the furnace door open, and I understood at last how that great complex machine of the man was actually run, the juice in the machine. Subsequently, a couple of weeks later, we met in Canberra. There was a dinner celebrating the centenary of Fisher's prime ministership, which he had chosen to attend rather than address the miners, who were having a huge dinner up the hill in the new government house, the new parliament house. This was in the old parliament house. And I'd come down from the new parliament house and looked down into that marble hall, which I think is the most beautiful room in that whole parliamentary palace. And there were all of the miners, and you know, the stench of rent-seeking was rising up to the ceiling, and everybody was tremendously sophisticated. It all looked like a fascinating night going on. Then I wandered down the hill, and there in the dining room of Old Parliament House was about 45 people gathered to hear what would turn out to be another of Rudd's not-so-interesting speeches. But before the speech, when he ought to have been mingling, he stood and just talked to a couple of us journalists. The shyness of the man under those circumstances had become legendary. He's not a good mingler. And we had a perfectly happy exchange at that point. Now, when he read what I wrote, I think he became unhappy. And he certainly feels invaded by my attempts to understand his character, which he dissents from, and that's fine. I still think stand up okay. We haven't had any communication since then, nor have I spoken to any but one of his old staff, who I met the other day, he hoped that my current task of going around with Julia Gillard would end more happily than the last.
Thanks. My experience was absolutely the reverse of David's. I had attempted, while I was writing my biography of Kevin Rudd, I was attempting desperately to get in touch with him, and he had decided he had somebody else writing a hagiography, and he wanted to cooperate with that. He didn't want to provide any assistance to mine. And so I became very angry with this little man. I was pursuing him around, you know, through other people. I was finding out more and more about Kevin Rudd, but I couldn't actually touch him or speak to him. And so I really did become quite annoyed with Kevin. And eventually, after I'd completed the book, I got my interview with Kevin Rudd. And you can imagine the little ball of anger that walked in to the prime minister, the opposition leader's suite at that time, and he offered me his hand, and I grudgingly shook it, and then he invited me to sit down, and gradually, over the next 5 minutes, he disarmed me completely. I was really furious by the time I walked out, because I hadn't expressed any of my anger, and I wanted to do that, but as a person, now I don't mean this in a negative way at all, he it wasn't manipulative. He was just really engaging me, with me in a very cerebral way that, displaced emotion, treated emotion as a almost... you could almost hold it and hold it out separately and look at that anger and admire it, but you were viewing it from afar. I just felt that I wasn't dealing with... When I began speaking to him, I just became aware of just how incredibly cognizant of all of these... of the way in which people worked he was. And so I almost made a deliberate decision not to speak to him for this book. There was one in between where I did speak to him for it. But this book, I thought, I don't want to get twisted into believing things his way, because his ability to spin is incredible. And so I wanted to really make sure that I stood outside the loop, that close inner circle, and didn't become one of the courtiers. And there's a longer discussion about Chinese, that Kevin Rudd and the influence of his Chinese study and the way in which he treats the world that we could go on to at some later point. But anyway.
Okay, so there's a question down there. There's
one person who doesn't seem to get a mention, and I would have thought she'd be quite important. That's his wife. He seems to have a very close relationship with his wife. Surely she'd be smart enough to say to him, Kevin, you can't run a country like this on your own.
We do have a roving mic. That was a question about Therese Rain. I think to David.
Well, she certainly gets a mention in the essay. She's absolutely crucial. They met on something like the first or second day that they were at university together. They were both young Christians. They met at a Christian breakfast of some kind, and before that conversation was finished, she had said to him, you should go into Parliament. She was completely, fundamentally crucial to his career. And like many political spouses, she has done many, many years of work smoothing things over for the politician. And that's a perfectly familiar pattern. Yes, she's... I have not heard a harsh word said about her. She's extraordinarily admired. But whether she advised Rudd, I don't know. That's something deep inside marriage. And marriages, all marriages, are foreign countries, and I don't have a passport to go there. And I'm not applying for one either.
Do you want to wait?
I simply say I agree absolutely with that. The thing is, we should be careful about... I mean, I don't know what their relationship is like. I know in the media it's extremely close. I'm not sure if any of the journalists who've been writing that know what it's like either. I mean, we can speculate. I think David's given an accurate answer. I suspect that we don't know more than we actually do know about their relationship.
One thing to add. In the years of Rudd's climb, and much of my essay is about the extraordinary way that he climbed to power and sort of sidestepped the distaste, really, of his own caucus. One of the things that caused people in caucus to be furious was the Rudd money, because they had the money to entertain people all the time. And so members of caucus would say, oh, there's Rudd's, you know, they're entertaining people every night. You know, every night of the week they've got people around there and they're whining them and dining them. It's just not fair.
I don't know about the inside of marriage, but an adoring wife is not very good for a narcissist. No help at all.
Now, we're not becoming psychiatric. We're not allowed to become psychiatric.
I wonder if the problem with Kevin Rudd, being the kind of person he is not that he never had anyone who did stand up to him. This came out in an article recently in the Sunday Telegraph. I think, I'm trying to think of the person, David Penberthy, I think, was the only person in the whole article who actually stood up to him. I think he's done it at the Sydney Institute. With those kind of people, you only get some reaction when you actually put something in their way and they need to get round it. And having seen him at the Midwinter Ball, make the most atrocious speech and embarrass all his colleagues and the media. It really, I thought, was time for him to see a shrink and take a long time out of work. And I'm serious about that. He really was, to me, a broken man, and it was shortly after that that he was assassinated. But why wasn't there anyone there who did anything to pull him into line and say, look, you won't be here for much longer if you don't do something about your problem?
Can I say, I think people did try and do that, and if you just look at what happened at the most famous example, which has been gone over ad nauseum, one of the plotters who actually assassinated Kevin was someone who Kevin had shouted at because he had dared to suggest that the parliamentary allowances for printing for senators and members should be allowed to continue. Kevin wanted to cut them. Kevin had decided they would be cut, and he argued against it because obviously the Labor Party, well, sitting members of both parties, can use the printing allowance to really, get their information out into the electorate. It's seen as being a big advantage of incumbency. As a result of that, they were saying, let's leave the allowances. Rudd just refused to listen to anything that they were saying. These people were sworn at, told to get out of the Prime Minister's office. There was no second hearing. Basically, I think by Christmas 2009, and this was when Kevin's close colleagues told him to take some proper time off, I think at that stage he'd already lost his fellow parliamentary members had lost the ability to speak to him.
And I still don't think we know properly the answer to that question. As I was saying before, I've spoken to some senior ministers since the downfall and have put the question to them, couldn't you talk to him? Now, part of this story is the gutlessness of the Labour caucus. Part of this story is the astonishing gutlessness of the cabinet. Imagine being a minister in this country and being willing to be treated in the way that ministers were treated under Rudd, with no proper circulation of cabinet submissions. They would arrive in cabinet and there would be a folder on the table in front of them, essentially telling them what they'd decided. They weren't allowed to take the folder away. It was bad and they copped it. By the way, there is an argument that it was Godwin Gretsch who brought Rudd down, because this high level of secrecy was imposed on the government partly because this tight control of information was imposed on the cabinet partly because of the earlier leaks that Gretsch had given to Malcolm Turnbull, given to the opposition. And then you have Newtgate, and that gets rid of it. It completely undermines Turnbull. Once Turnbull's gone, you get Abbott. So, there's an argument along those lines. But why didn't a bunch of senior ministers simply get together and barge through his door and say, look, mate, you are in trouble unless you mend your ways? I think it's part of the peculiar chemistry of the man that he was able to fend that off. I mean, one of the things... He's not mad. He's a highly, highly capable man with some extraordinary flaws. But one of the things he used to do was to refuse to see ministers who gave him any trouble. He closed his door to them. Or he would suggest they could fly to Brisbane and join him on a flight to Darwin if they wanted to talk about their problems. He kept people waiting. He punished people who caused him grief. And those people were very often his own ministers. Now, he controlled the government closely enough so that you couldn't act unless he ticked off on what you wanted to do. If you caused trouble, you couldn't get in to see him to tick off on the work that you had to do. So people were left dangling a lot of the time. I mean, Garrett was dangling over the pink bat stuff. And while I have no sympathy for him whatever on this issue, Conroy and the mad notions of filtering the internet so that we'll all live in a clean, pure world as decided by the government. He knew that there had to be radical changes to those proposals. He could not get into Rudd to see them. Dick Woolcott could not get into Rudd to report back on his attempts to set up this common market in the Far East. You closed the door. Now, under those circumstances, it became tactically difficult to actually confront the man. I'm sure none of this is an accident in his part, but of course it led in the end to the decision that execution was the only cause.
Lindsay Ellison? Just hang on a second, Lindsay. Right, here we go.
The question is ultimately to David Marr, and in particular in his capacity as someone who writes opinion pieces for papers. As I think we understand it, opinion writers are expected to know more, to occasionally be insiders, to have the extra information which gives their opinion title. Just a few examples. Mark Latham is regarded, when he was leader of the opposition, as the new messiah.
For a while.
For a while. And Kevin Rudd and Malcolm Turnbull. Malcolm Turnbull is advised to vote for the government's trading scheme. At the end of the parliamentary sitting, everyone says that, well, the sitting's over, there'll be no challenge in the winter's break. Tony Abbott is supposed to be a hopeless campaigner, and to use your example, it's rubbish that there'll be a decapitation. Everyone respects you for the opinions you write, but what I'd like to know is, having made that one extra step and made that statement, we very rarely see the reflection of the opinion writers as to how, with all the, in your case, with all the research, with all the context, you got it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
What I want to know is, where do we see the self-criticism occasionally from the opinion writers?
Well, partly by me opening my speech by saying I was wrong, which you must acknowledge.
But how were you wrong?
Well, exhibit A in my defence. This man was certain four or five hours before it happened. I filed my essay 3 or 4 weeks before it happened. We get things wrong. I mean, everybody in the press gallery was wrong. Dennis Shanahan, a few days before it happened, said there's a move afoot, something like that. But he says that everywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
So there was nothing new there. It wasn't as though Dennis sort of set off a fever of speculation, because there was a sense that, you know, that's Dennis again. We get things wrong. I go around saying up front, I was wrong, because events changed after I wrote that piece. Things changed dramatically. Now, I was aware that there was talk that Rudd had become so friendless in caucus that if there was a move, he was gone, reported in my piece. Emphatically from me, this is rubbish. I was wrong. Now, my way of going at this is to tell everybody I was wrong. I find it astonishing to find the essay reviewed as it was the other day in The Australian, as though this was somehow kind of some discovery. Fair enough, I was wrong, and they say so in The Australian. And it's good to be back where I like to be with The Australian, because when the essay came out, I was on page one and praised, and I thought, this situation can't last. But it didn't. But, you know, Jared from... I say this very, very tentatively, that once or twice Jared's been wrong. And you know, we all struggle with confession about error. But sometimes error comes in for the simple reason that fundamental facts shift in unpredicted ways. My way of approaching it is to always say, when I am wrong, emphatically, I am wrong. I don't see any point in trying to weasel around it.
I didn't think this ended up in such a cathartic atmosphere. Look, this is like a general confession day. Three Hail Marys and everything's okay.
Can I just add two things to that, two quick things?
Yeah.
Firstly, I believe that as I said, I think David Marr did change the game. The publication of that essay actually made possible what later happened. And the second thing I want to add is that I'm not aware of Gerard ever being wrong.
He's the one doing my part.
They'll do anything to get a Guernsey at the Sydney Institute. They'll do anything. It's a question there, yeah.
David, both of you have made the point that Rudd listens to nobody. But early in your opening remarks, you pointed out that Rudd started to listen to the gang of three and a half. There's some conflict there that I don't quite understand.
Righto. I'm not arguing that Rudd listened to nobody. Rudd has a way of treating advisers as if they were research assistants, a point made to me by somebody who'd worked very closely with him. Rudd likes the raw material to deal with, and therefore the advisers become the research assistants, bringing him the raw material. But he does listen to advisers, and he did. He's not incapable of being persuaded, and Nicholas has got some terrific passages in his book which talk about how people persuade Rudd to change his mind. It's not that. But he did not... He was not comfortable having around him advisers of senior status. I mean, the Gang of Four was highly influential in the way the government was run. And prime ministers always are the ones who make the final decisions. And while I agree with Nicholas's description of how extraordinarily meddling Rudd was in the work of other ministers, so is any prime minister with a brain in his head. I mean, Fraser ran every single ministry in his government, more or less because he had to. That's a little unfair to the reputation of one or two. Well, you know, one went on to be, you know, a very successful prime minister. But Fraser had to... Fraser used to keep having those breakdowns because he was sort of running it all. He was a control freak. So was, you know, being a control freak, you have to be prime minister of this country. But there are degrees of it. There are limits. And Rudd was not somebody who absolutely refused to listen. But unfortunately, at the beginning of this year, for him, he began to take the advice of the people who were telling him to become more cautious and to postpone issues on which his whole reputation was based.
Now we're getting close to the end, so we're going to be very brief with questions and answers. So we go to Chin Jin, a very brief Chin.
Mr. David Ma, I watched your program at 7:30 about a couple of months ago when you were talking to Kerry O'Brien.
Yes.
The debacle, specifically used this word in my article to describe this election. That was very interesting. I noticed that Kevin Rudd has a personality doesn't refuse to listen to anybody. We call it the cooking ducks. Mouth or lips. So this is our saying. Now the question is, maybe you can answer me, maybe you can't. After he was disposed, he had a holiday in China. Is there any special implications to his career?
I think there's another sitting in scoop.
Look, as I say, I was studying Patrick White at the time. So I didn't know of a holiday in China. I thought he went to America, didn't he?
The rumour at first was that he went to China, but actually he went to America and New York, as we now know.
Yes. Oh, yes, he went to the leadership dialogue.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we got rid of that. So Hillary, got to be very brief. Okay.
Seeing that the assessments for the New South Wales right, and they've had such a disastrous effect in New South Wales, what do you think if Gillard wins the election, how much power are they going to have in Canberra?
Do I need to add words after I've said that? Look, it's not just the New South Wales right. It was the right across the party, and that included elements of the right in Victoria and in other states as well. Though Mark Habib, who having led Rudd into making a couple of disastrous decisions, was then put on the outer. I mean, one of the things Rudd did was, having, to my mind, finally worked out that Mark Habib is one of nature's lightweights, he had put him out, at which point Habib starts the plotting. It's just completely Shakespearean. It's just, you know, we know all of those plots. But if they win, if they get through, those men will be regarded as political geniuses. And when I was in England, there was a lot of commentary at that time about how spectacularly professional and tough-minded the Australian Labor Party had been, because it had done to Rudd what they all wanted to do to Gordon Brown.
I think that's absolutely right. Let's wait till the election result. Let's see how many seats are lost, where they're lost. lost, and as a result of that, then we'll be able to work out just where power resides. But on the other hand, if you think Julia Gillard's going to be pushed around, then I suggest you haven't met Julia Gillard.
So there's a question over there, and we have the final one here. So second last over there, we've got to be brief, okay?
Nicholas, if the New South Wales Right didn't necessarily have Julia Gillard in mind in the initial stages, who did they have in mind?
Oh, that's easy. They had Nauru. David knows. I think this is a very floating political beast. Everyone was aware that Kevin was, even then, I think, you know, we were looking at some sort of longer term. I don't think Kevin wanted to stay around for more than two terms. One and a half might have done him. And at that point, I think he might have been prepared to hand over. I think there's all this jockeying. People were talking about it, but there was no definite names.
I disagree. I think it's a bit venturesome of Nicholas to say that. Gillard was absolutely the heir apparent, whatever happened to Rudd. There was no way she could be shifted at that point. And particularly because this notion that she's somehow a left-winger is a misunderstanding of the faction system and the labelling system. She is a highly pragmatic, strategic politician, and she presents no problems whatever to the right wing. There was no way it would be anybody else, in my view, than Gillard.
Do you believe that Kevin Rudd would have been happy with one and a half terms? It'd be unusual.
I don't. The talk that he was only using Australia as a stepping stone to the United Nations never convinced me at all. This was his lifetime's goal, to be Prime Minister of this country, which is why, for all of my criticism of him, I feel astonishingly deeply for him to be dragged down in that way. Can you imagine what it is like?
Now, there's a final question. Nicholas, you want to make a brief comment?
Just very quick. Look, I absolutely agree, and I know from someone very close to Julia Gillard, I think there was no other alternative for at least 18 months other than Julia Gillard. I think after that, her office were very aware that things might have been in flux.
Final question here. Yep.
One of the more intriguing aspects of this election campaign seems to be that we've got the sudden reelistment of this man who was so clinically dispatched as being the reason for the federal government having lost its way. Presumably, this was done to assuage pain felt most in most concentrated form in Queensland and in other parts of the country. Do you both feel that it's going to work?
Well, it's much better to have Rudd in the tent than outside the tent. And I think it's, to my mind, it was a turning point in the campaign when he came out. He even put an Australian flag beside him. The blue back cloth and the Australian flag, it couldn't have been more prime ministerial. And he came out and endorsed Gillard. Can you imagine how hard that would be for somebody in his position to do? I think it's a very important step in it all. And I think it really counts that Latham then stumbles onto the scene. And if you want to talk about the dead, you should have been at the Liberal launch on Sunday, as I was, in Brisbane. It was like being in Hades. There were these shades wandering around. And all of them, you know, believing they're destined for the ministry again. I mean, we're going to have Kevin Andrews and Bronwyn Bishop and Philip Ruddock back in the ministry. And they're the face of, you know, a man who, after a career that much of what he did I didn't much like, but John Howard is the most professional politician any of us will experience in our lifetimes, and he was defeated solidly and lost his seat, and there he was with his image presiding over the entire thing. You talk about bringing back from the dead. Good heavens.
Not a comment, Nicholas.
Yeah, look, I think when the only possible way Labor could scrape towards election was by getting Kevin Rudd back on board. I don't know that he's quite as popular in some parts of Queensland, but he really worked those two seats, that the seat of Herbert, the seat of Capricornia, where Julia Gillard was campaigning last week. Without him, I think Labor would find it extremely difficult. And it is quite incredible, or great magnanimity, but on the other hand, it's also in Kevin's own interests to help. But that's in no way meant to denigrate the fact that he is actually now genuinely acting as honestly, in the best way he can, as a representative of the Australian people and the people who elected him.
Many thanks. I'll be very brief. I've had a very informative night, but it's also been a lot of fun, so thanks both to David Maher and to Nicholas Stewart. David Maher's essay, Power Trip, without question, is probably the most influential essay written in Australia in the last decade, so it's been great to have David Maher here along tonight talking about it. Maybe more than a decade, but certainly... it's a very influential
kiss of
essay.
Death. Thank you.
And I've yet to read Stewart's book because the publisher didn't send me a copy. But I can say that the first biography of Kevin Rudd was by far the best account of Kevin Rudd that came out just after Mr. Rudd became Prime Minister, and I'm sure the second the latest book will be in that tradition. So we'll be reviewing it in the next issue of the Sydney Institute Quarterly. So I just want to say tonight, thanks to a great audience, great questions, great discussion, and thanks to David Maher and Nicholas Stewart, and their copies of their books are over there, and I'm sure they'll be happy to sign it. So well done, David.
Thank you, George.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.